Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. God, I've missed you guys. Well, it's been 2 weeks. Well, in the case of Lipton, it's been about a week. But in the case of Paul, it's been 2 weeks. So, and I've been away gallivanting around England. And, our guest is finally here. Our guest is here. Yes, I'll put him in. Yes, I'll start again. Right, hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I hope you've had an interesting couple of weeks. I'm so sorry to have been away. And I hope everything has been going well. So we're going to be all kind of, it's amazing, chaps. I was watching the Eurovision Song Contest in the Finnish Eurovision, the song for Finland, and then the entry that should have won, which is called Tick Attacker or something, which was this fascinating guy from Kokkola, sung a funny song about shaving. He didn't win. And then there was just some old tart that used to be famous in Finland that did win. And it seems that this upset Donald Trump so much that he declared war on Iran.
Where was he from, Ed? Kokkola.
Yeah, Kokkola, yeah.
And you can get tablets for that.
Or in Swedish, Karlebu, that he took out the Iranian leader. So that's fast. So that's, I think, what must have happened. Anyway, so cheers, everybody. Cheers, Paul.
Cheers.
Cheers, Alistair. I'll introduce you later. Cheers, Lipton. He's a bit frozen, isn't he?
No, that's not good. At least you're frozen smiling.
No, that's why he's late. That's why he was late. He was late because there was some kind of computer cock-up. Anyway, cheers,
Well, it
Lipton.
Wouldn't be the Jolly Heretic without chaos.
No, that is indeed true. Lipton, your sound isn't on for some reason. Shall I put it on?
He's muted himself. There you go.
Oh, has he? Has he? All right, cheers. Yes, where was I? Yes, so cheers, Paul. Cheers, Lipton.
Scrub your name.
Capis. Salud. Saludo.
Yakida.
Slanger.
Lachaim.
And welcome to... And that.
Mazel Tov.
And welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. We meet on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science, interesting stuff that's in the news, research, and that kind of stuff. And now Paul's frozen. I don't know what's going on today. And that is increasingly expunged from our woke joke university. So, yes, cheers. We were late. We were late indeed. Hello, hello from Peekskill, New York. Hello, Mary Ann from Peekskill, New York. Cheers to you. And hello, Nimble Horse. And cheers. Now, we have a very special guest for you today, which I think he's been having computer problems because he's frozen again. And he was frozen a minute ago he was late. So actually, we might not be having a special. It might be like that time we had Paula on. Remember when we had Paula on and she just kept crashing? It might be like that. I think it's going to be. And that guest is, yeah, he is frozen, is Dr. Alistair Marshall, who is Associate Professor in Risk Management at Southampton University.
And can I channel what he'd say, Ed?
Okay, yeah, you pretend to be him. So could you do like a sort of a mild Scottish accent, not unlike the chemist? I am not obstructing your say.
Have you had your dinner?
No, I don't understand how this is. Are you there, Alistair?
I'm here now, apologies. My internet has been perfect for years, literally for years. And right over, just over the past 10 minutes or so, it's decided to connect and disconnect and so on.
Alistair, so, it's the metal plate in Lipton's head interferes with the frequency.
it could be that the Secret Services are interfering with the Jolly Heretic. I mean, we have the usual thing of, it could be that. Anyway, so Alistair, could you possibly introduce yourself to the assembled?
He's frozen again.
Lipton's
flashing in a non-sexual manner.
Yeah,
Alistair's
sorry,
back.
I missed that. I went off again, and so I didn't hear your question.
Tell us who you are.
Okay, I'm Alistair Marshall. I'm an associate professor in Southampton Business School. I'm sort of balanced between management academia. I deal with risk management in business school academia. And I also have a background in Pareto and elite theory. And so I'm sort of uniquely positioned to derive certain insights by, you know, combining both of these areas. And I see I'm still connected, so hopefully I can keep talking a bit more.
You will freeze in a minute. But we were going to talk about the Iran war. So as far as I'm concerned, this could get very, very serious. If there's a petrol crisis like in the 70s, it could get very bad. So how do you see this? Let's talk about this, the Iran war, in terms of elite theory then. What do you think is going on in the background that's not being put in the foreground?
Yeah, well, the thing about the Iran war is, I mean, my main insight, it wouldn't be directly from elite theory. It would be more from sort of US military intelligence speak. This is an extreme example of a VUCA environment, you know, volatile, uncertain, complex.
I'm sorry, chaps. I don't know how this is going to happen.
I'm sorry about this. If it keeps happening, I'll go inside. I'll unplug the router for 10 seconds and hope that solves
it. Hang on. You're broadcasting from a shed.
This is my writer's cabin in the west of Scotland.
Alice, have you tried opening the windows?
So what you're saying, Alistair, is you're in the rural west of Scotland. You're in the, where are you, like the Hebrides or something?
I'm in Ayr. I'm on the west coast.
I've been to Troon. I went to a wedding in Troon.
That's not far away. Yeah.
Beautiful place.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it. So the fact that there's a place called Troon and you're near there, and that's a significant settlement, implies you are in the middle of nowhere.
Ed, I am not a golfer. Troon is like a famous golf course, you philistine.
Anyway, sorry, Alistair, carry on. So what were you thinking about the Iran war, which may destroy us all?
The main thing is the inherent instability. From an elite theory perspective, there's instability on pretty much all sides. If you look at the American side, then the problem is you have a political system which is essentially in my last appearance in the Jolly Heretic, I talked about anocratic decay, political systems and anocratic decay. And that basically means that from here on in, as Republicans replace Democrats and Democrats replace Republicans, democratic elections are tantamount to handing your enemy a loaded gun. It's a very, very dangerous period. So there's a lot of instability that is arising from that.
That's very interesting. And Paul and Lipton, feel free to intervene. But why are these elections akin to handing your enemy a loaded gun?
Because the US political system has descended into lawfare. If you look at everything that the Trump regime has done to the Democrats, if you look at what Doge has tried to do, for example, you can only imagine what payback is going to look like when you get a Democrat administration.
Oh, I see. Right.
That's the issue. So that is an inherently unstable situation. You don't know what American foreign policy is going to look like come the next general election, whenever that is. And it may look very different. Now, realism needs to look ahead. It needs to look at all of the players and the conflict needs to look ahead at what the world is going to look like post-Trump. And no one knows. So there's that's what makes the situation.
Presumably, if trust is so low, and that elections are handing your enemy a loaded gun that they can shoot your face off with, then what that militates in favour of is just not really having elections, isn't it?
Precisely, and so there's ambiguity around that as well. There's going to be very low trust as election time looms. And even when elections do take place, the results are going to be contested, and there's going to be threat of civil disorder around that as well. And so that's what I mean when I say that there's uncertainty, a lot of uncertainty and instability at the US end. There's also uncertainty at the Israeli end. If you look at Netanyahu's ascendancy to power. Before the attacks on Israel that prompted the invasion of Gaza, Israel was in a state of near civil disorder because of Netanyahu's efforts to make judicial changes, And so to some extent, his foray into Gaza has started to rally people around the flag, but Israeli Jews, I think, remain divided over whether or not it was a good idea. But in the case of Iran, I think Israeli Jews perceive that there's a real existential threat there, and so they're very much in favour of the invasion at the moment. But nonetheless, there's going to be a post Netanyahu era as well, and people have got to look forward to that. And so there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of what that's going to look like, also what Netanyahu is trying to achieve.
Usually my history teacher at school in the mid-90s said that if a right-wing government, by which he meant a Netanyahu government, was elected in the next few days, there'd be World War III because of that. That's what he said in the mid-90s. And yeah. Netanyahu was elected, and there wasn't World War III, obviously. And now this is a bit of a war, isn't it, chaps? Is anyone else? Paul, what do you think? Do you think this is a war, Paul? We're war?
What I'm interested in is everyone turns into an armchair general and they all have what they think is the skinny on the military tactics and so on, which I think is bullshit because we're not privy to the actual intelligence. Strikes me that it's been a long time coming. It's interesting how history will view people. So on a personal level, I think Donald Trump's a pathological narcissist. But I think history will view Obama as having basically fueled Iran and allowed Iran for the last, since 2015, he did the deal on the nuclear agreement that gave them access to was $100 billion. So he's basically, helped them arm terrorist groups from around the world. So I can see, and Andrew Neil this morning, some of the analysis I just get slightly confused by. Andrew Neil was arguing it's a disaster because he hasn't secured the Straits of Hormuz, but then he's admitted that the Straits of Hormuz won't really affect America because they're energy self-sufficient. So the energy crisis is going to hit Europe, who are too bloody, weak and pathetic to defend themselves or even pay for other people to do it. So I just think it's a huge, big, I'm trying to think of a polite phrase, but I am fascinated. I'm glad in a way it's happened because I think the Ayatollahs need to be dealt with. And I'm interested in the America First movement. So Megyn Kelly and people, certain figures like Matt Walsh, they're very much against it. But it strikes me, what is their response to if the Mullahs ever did get the bomb? It's a bit late to respond then. So I don't understand their mentality either.
That was crazy. Like, why the hell didn't they respond in 1979 when this happened? The response should have been, Carter was in charge and he was wishy-washy. But once Reagan was in charge, he goes after Libya or whatever. Like, surely, go after this place and stop it. It's an unfriendly. We need oil. Our civilization is completely reliant on oil. Without oil, we're screwed. Oil is our bronze or oil is our iron. We need oil. And so you can't have unstable regimes in these areas.
Well, I do think I'm a great believer, being the eternal optimist that I am, that things need to get worse before they can get better. And I think there's deep dysfunctionality within Europe. And it's like being a frog boiled alive. It's just slowly degenerating. So something worse needs to happen. A good old energy crisis might shake some things from the trees. And let's see what happens. But I'm just fed up with the slow decline, to be honest.
Because presumably, Paul and Alistair, do you remember the 70s and the candles?
Oh, yeah. The three-day week, which under Labour governments is about 2 days more work than most people normally manage.
Do you remember the energy crisis, Alistair?
Yeah, I remember, being scared in the dark. And was it 1972, 1973? I was very young, just moved into a new house and remember being scared in the dark because of the power cuts. So, I can just remember that.
God, and in Scotland as well, in the dark in Scotland, even more frightening place than England.
How would you know it was dark in Scotland, though? It's just, that's your average noon time.
That is That is true. He's
Alistair, I spent 7 years in Edinburgh, so I never saw the sun for 7 years.
Yeah,
he's frozen again.
I think I'm gonna have to tell him to go out into another Hebridean island where the internet is, unplug the internet in Oost, and plug it back in again. I think that's the only solution. But yeah, it could get extremely dangerous. I mean, people think that COVID, not that I really experienced it, unfortunately, in northern Finland, but people think that COVID was bad. But this is much worse. If you can't get petrol for your car, if you can't, there's just nothing will work. The food supply, yeah, he's gone to unplug the internet.
Well, think about most working class people in the UK will probably die of starvation because they can't get Deliveroo.
No, this is true. And the corruption you see there as well. You know, one thing I noticed when I was in London is these Deliveroo riders, and they're riding these sort of hybrid bicycles where you like almost like a Sinclair C5. You know, remember those? Where you power it partly by cycling, and then it powers a battery. And clearly they've installed something, so effectively it's a motorbike. And that's what they've done. They're not cycling. You don't see them cycling. They just zoom along, which is illegal. Low-level crime, which is overlooked. But yeah, this Iran crisis could get very, very bad. And then what, I don't know, like the Prime Minister as well has shown Britain's, do you think, Paul, Alistair, Lipton, Libby Lipton, you haven't talked yet, that the Prime Minister has shown Britain's absolute weakness, I think, by vacillating. You know, are we on the side of the mullahs or are we on the side of civilization?
Ed, my hello, Alistair Marshall. I love academics and you're an academic, a real academic, unlike Ed. Ed has real degrees and he has published in legitimate journals, but he's not a real academic.
No.
Am I not? We
agree, no. Lipton.
Yeah, Ed is just a smart guy who writes people. He's not an academic.
He's a clickbaiter, isn't he? Ed's a clickbaiter.
Yes.
Professor clickbaiter.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, Lipton, I've only published 160 papers in academic journals, but all right.
Letters to Razzle don't count, Ed.
That's a separate section on my website, Paul, as you well know.
What's interesting about this war is that the usual elites who support intervention are not behind it. Many energy executives are upset. Robert Kagan, a leading neoconservative writer, he's upset. He's not supporting the war. Other people in the establishment have written op-eds criticizing Donald Trump. And I find their responses to be quite weird. For some strange reason, they oppose the war with Iraq. They claim usually they ignore intelligence when it does not suit them, but now they're saying that the intelligence does not support Iran's ambitions, which again I find to be quite weird because they supported the war in Iraq when the intelligence said otherwise. So we're living in interesting times.
Well, we ignore intelligence in Britain, don't we? I mean, you have everybody telling Sir Keir Starmer that Sir Peter Mandelson is a pervert, is connected to a pervert, and is corrupt, and is leaking. You know, is very dodgy, and he gets appointed the ambassador to America.
But Ed, I think you're being completely unfair there, because how on earth could the leading prosecutor in the country possibly be expected to realise a friend of a paedophile might be a bad ambassador? I think you're being ridiculously unfair.
I don't see how you could know that. But let's to turn to it though, Alistair. So state the title of your I forget it. It's so long winded. The title of your brilliant book again.
It's rereading Pareto on Elite Power and Societal Bipolarization: A Critical Perspective on Metapolitics and Democracy. And I know that sounds long winded. I know it sounds like I've swallowed a Scrabble board. But apparently it's to optimize internet search. So some publishers encourage these long-winded titles.
Well, it's also Schmitty in a sense, isn't it? I mean, you've got a discussion of me in it, you've got a discussion of various people I know. And it has to be presented in a very academic way, I think, to get past the bastard peer reviewers.
Yeah,
because there isn't just peer review these days, chaps. There's queer review. There's two kinds of review. And you have to get past both. And so from that perspective, one of the things that we've talked about on here is in nationalism and the differences between civic and ethno-nationalism. You wanted to bring that into the frame. So what were you thinking about this?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I wrote a Substack essay a couple of weeks ago on civic nationalism. And it's something that I've been thinking about it for a while. You know, when the television's on, the go-to news channel is GB News. And after, you know, months and months of you know, watching them talk about, especially the migrant crisis, especially the small boats crossing the channel in particular, I had this epiphany that the passions that they're speaking from and which they're speaking to in the audience are nationalist, but the moral logic that they're translating these passions into is liberal. So if you think about it, everything that they say about, you know, what's wrong with the channel crossings, it's compatible with liberal moral logic. They will say things like it's important to smash the gangs. It's important to stop crime. It's important to save. It's important from a sort of child protection and from a women's safety point of view. It's important from a public financing point of view. All of that is compatible with a liberal moral logic. Whereas what they in part want to say, but they feel they can't because they're constrained, is, you know, we want our country back. You know, so there are nationalist passions which are being
repressed. What I'd say to that is, it's the way the media rules out certain modes of communication. So I saw a Reform candidate apologise for having used the phrase born and bred. And then I saw, who's that Guardian guy, the really annoying little, doesn't narrow it down, but the little guy, Owen whatever, I saw him use the same phrase and he wasn't pulled up on it at all. But there is, you're just not allowed to say, for example, when Matt Goodwin tried to distinguish between citizenship and ethnicity, I think I said this last time, ethnicity, you know, if I went to Lagos, I don't suddenly become Nigerian. I could get a Nigerian passport, perhaps, but I'm still an English person, expat, living in Lagos. So the idea that just because you have a British passport, you have to be called English, doesn't happen anywhere else in the world.
There is an element of adoption, though, isn't there? Because if you think about it, Paul, like, you are ethnically Irish, as far as I can work out. Yeah. And that makes you more genetically distant from me than Germans, Scandinavians. But yeah, I see you as one of my group, as my in-group. So there's something as English, essentially, even though you are Scouse, which is a subset of English, but it, you know what I mean? And so there's an interesting tension in defining ethnicity or nationality, where it is mainly genetic, sure, but then there's a degree to which if they pass sufficiently as English, because they look English and they speak English, then it's like if they look like a duck and they quack like a duck.
Well, there's certain things, like, it is interesting. I used to be quite pro-Irish until the whole woke mind virus destroyed that country. But the rugby test, and the rugby test has been ruined because now you have South Africans playing for Scotland. No offence, Alistair, but Scotland historically at rugby have been bloody useless. Guess what? You get a load of South African players and you've suddenly become really good. But the point is, I won't support Ireland. When there's a rugby match, I automatically support England. I wouldn't support Ireland in a month of Sundays. So it's visceral. I've got some Irish heritage, but viscerally I feel English.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because, are you basically completely genetically Irish?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can see. I mean, I have a good friend. Well, you've met her actually. That is adopted. She's from South America, but she's as Scouts as they come. You know.
Yeah, we went. I went nicking car hubs with a wheel hubs that night. Remember?
Did you? I don't remember.
Yeah, no, she's really quick at it.
But she's so, you know, she's in every way. Well, not Scouse, she's from the Wirral, but you know what I mean. So it's a really fascinating thing. Whereas it is that's why there's this tension, because it is when these people say, look, to be English means you've got English ancestry. That's it. Boom, boom, boom. It's not. It is slightly more than that. It is slightly more complicated than that. And intelligent people can debate whether, you know, Frank Bruno at the end of the day is one of us. Know what I mean? And shouldn't have to be sent home. Anyway, Alistair, so this is what do you think about this?
Yeah, well, in this essay that I wrote on Substack, I thought it'd be interesting to frame this problem, this continual inhibition and hesitation that's going on in the minds of civic nationalism, of civic nationalists, as a form of cognitive dissonance. So it's a psychic discomfort. So I thought it would be interesting to give it a name, which is the great discomfort. So I've got this theory which says that civic nationalism today is the great discomfort of our age, and what our politics is going to look like. Well, what our whole society, if not civilization, is going to look like in a few years' time, is going to depend to a large extent on what civic nationalists in particular decide to do. Are they going to acquiesce towards liberal post-nationalism? Are they going to stay in what I call their abusive relationship with liberal post-nationalism, which is steadily undermining the conditions for nationalist sentiment? Or are they going to lean more into cultural nationalism and ethnic nationalism in the years to come? Because this is what's going to shape our politics, and it's all on the shoulders of civic nationalists. It's all.
Alistair, can I ask you something? Because it strikes me, I was always puzzled when Thatcher and Norman Tebbit were in charge, and they were deeply conservative from a cultural standpoint, but every one of their economic policies exacerbated cultural influxes from elsewhere, and it just seemed to be a complete contradiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk about this in my book. I think that the early 80s were a sort of cultural inflection point where political conservatives became liberal. So that's really when it happened. It was when I mean, you could say that in terms of the neoliberal experiment, it started you know, a decade before with Chile. You know, Pinochet and the Chicago Boys economists, their influence. But since the 1980s, we've really moved to a situation now where if you ask a conservative, inverted commas, political leader what the fundamental, you know, conservative values are, and they'll reply with liberalism.
Yeah,
they've completely forgotten what conservatism is. And yet, I argue in my book, I work from very basic principles. I work from what I call a sort of metapolitical view of human nature, which says that politics comes into being because of two great countervailing principles from human nature, which can be called conservatism and liberalism. Now, the way things have gone, you know, the forces of modernity over the course of the 20th century, all of that has undermined conservatism. Nonetheless, throughout the 20th century, there has been an uneasy, you know, fluid settlement of sorts between conservative and liberal principles. There's always been some sort of there's always been an uneasy peace between the two principles. But it's only really with the rise of wokeness that has ended, and that's why we have the factional bipolarization that we have now. But the point is that what's been happening over the past 20 years is not the eradication of conservatism, because you can't eradicate it, because in my philosophy it's part of human nature. All you can do is repress it. And so I would go to a large extent with this sort of learning from history meta-narrative, which says that the mid-20th century, you know, Soviet and Eastern European communist elites made a huge mistake by thinking they could repress nationalism. It didn't work. And today's liberal elites are doing exactly the same thing. They haven't learned from history in that sense. And so ultimately, when I argue from first principles, and I talk about these two countervailing principles of conservatism and liberalism, I'm a metapolitical pluralist. I'm a democrat. I think that both of these fundamental principles need to be allowed to express if you're to have what can, you know, reasonably be called a mature democracy. You know,
we have these. If you agree with, you know, Jonathan Haidt's moral foundations, and he argues that, you know, the five moral foundations. The conservatives have all five. The liberals are high in the individually oriented ones, and the far right are high in the group oriented ones. And if you go too far, and you go down the road of things that, in terms of repressing group orientation in favour of equality and harm avoidance, you repressing nationalism, you get a backlash, like we saw in Yugoslavia, a terrible backlash. And if you repress the liberal, you know, the sense of equality and harm avoidance, particularly harm avoidance, I guess, then you're going to get a terrible backlash that way. If it's considered that you just don't care about people and their emotional needs, you're going to get a backlash. So we inherently have both. But it seems to me that what he's saying is that conservatism, literally conservatism, balances both. But then we always move left because there's asymmetrical empathy. Conservatives understand equality. They're into equality and harm avoidance. They just think there's other things that matter.
This is a chat for another time. But if there's, I saw a mini video the other day about, you know, the Basque language, Euskera. Mm-hmm. There was a study of geneticists. This is what's in your ballywick. There was a geneticist did a study, and the Basques are incredibly genetically homogenous. And there is no relationship of the Basque language to any other language in Europe, if not the world. And he equated the reason why they could stay genetically so unadulterated was their unique language. And I think part of the nationalism problem with English is that it's a language that's used by the whole world. So it opened up English culture to cross-fertilization, like hasn't happened for populations like the Basque.
No, exactly. I mean, that's what they said. One idea was there's an episode of Alan Partridge, the second series, not the hotel, but the Static Caravan series. And he's got a Ukrainian girlfriend. And he says to Lynn, speak very quickly, she won't understand you. So maybe that's what we should do. We should just all speak very quickly.
I think Lipton's ahead of the curve, though, on not being understood.
Speak very quickly and in a very pronounced accent. So like one time, first time I came to Edinburgh, for the Edinburgh Festival in 1999, me and my friend asked directions from some dustmen to get to Morningside, and it was just noise. Their accent was probably only as strong as Alistair's, or maybe a bit stronger.
No, I was on a bus. I was on the top deck of a bus in Edinburgh when I'd first arrived, and I was from, you know, Liverpool, so I was used to accents, and I honestly thought they were German.
Yeah,
it took me a while to realise. And who was this bloke? Ken? Every bloody third word.
Yeah, there was a very pretentious girl at Aberdeen University who was English. She was definitely English, but she adopted a Scottish accent and then started speaking in Doric. It was just a ludicrous thing to do. She said, "I a Kenya, I like shut up. You're from like Guildford." Or it wasn't even.
I sensed, Led. I'm sensing. I'm channeling now. I sensed you asked her out, and she told you to bugger off.
I didn't. She was one of them practicing pagans. She was weird. My Scottish friend Gregor, actually, who was a Christian, was good friends with her, but he was from Dunfermline. But I got used to the accent very quickly. But that's what we need to do. You're right. A big part of the problem is that to come to Finland, decreasingly so. But to come to Finland, you've got to speak Finnish. It's decreasingly the case, unfortunately.
Right.
So now in the Burger King at Helsinki Airport, they know where they're from, Nigeria or something, and they don't speak Finnish at all. And that's just accepted now. Whereas I remember in Amsterdam Airport in about 2003, that was the case. They didn't speak Dutch. And this was irritating to Dutch people. Took the view, well, hang on, we're at an airport in the Netherlands. Why the hell? Yes, we speak English, but so what? It's outrageous.
Godverdomme.
Godverdomme, yeah. It's a godverdomme klootzak. Het is godverdomme slechte ding dat hij geen Engels spreken. But ja.
Oké, dan. Ja. All right.
Ik wil graag een land in... Where the mensen in the... What's airport? I can't remember. Flugport. Het Engels spreken. Ja, het Engels spreken goed. Right.
Lipton, Ed just accused you of having a prolapsed rectum. Is this true?
Well, I'm not listening to Ed. I wanted to say that the West is in a quagmire. It's not quagmire because there are people who want to articulate an American foreign policy that's America-oriented. But the issue with an American-oriented foreign policy is that Westerners have an abstract culture. The Chinese do not. So the Chinese, their foreign policy is not grounded in philosophy, economic freedom, or any other grand ideology of the left. So Americans are in a strange situation. They want to be America first, but at the same time, they're interested in getting rid of tyrannical regimes. They care about geopolitics in other places, even when America is not at a disadvantage. So I think that's the big issue now in foreign policy, and people are not talking about it. Americans, in a sense, they have lost their voice. They have an abstract culture. That's the issue. And because
of... Lipton, don't you think that Trump targeting Iran after he've targeted Venezuela, I think it's realpolitik. He's after the oil, and he's trying to stop China. No, so in that sense, it's good from a foreign policy objective because it's practical. It's not about abstract ideas of changing the regime. He wants the mullahs decimated, and he wants China to less oil.
Yeah, Pete did say that they're not interested in changing regimes, and I do get the point about decimating the mullahs and getting the oil. But the broader issue is that I was naive, but I expected Donald Trump to be a bit more transactional. But as a leader of America in a Western context, that's quite difficult. So I think that's where the trouble is. American foreign policy is just a bit incoherent at the moment. They don't know if they really want to become like the Chinese, people who are transactional, who will ignore corruption, or will they continue with liberal humanitarianism? They're a bit lost.
Ed, could I ask you a question about the right? It interests me that the right, I think there are spiteful mutants obviously on the left, but increasingly there are spiteful anti-Semitic mutants on the right.
Yes.
And the spiteful right-wing mutants, there's a few of them in the comments section, they are very quick to point out whenever the IDF kill anyone, but absolutely silent when the Iranian mullahs killed up to 40,000 of their own people. And it's just such a blatant hypocritical omission. What do you think?
I think, as we've discussed, let me just do a bit of advertising here. as we explained to you many times.
Quakers.
The Quakers.
You're making Alistair hungry. It's oats time, Alistair.
The Quakers control the Jews and lead them astray. It's the Quakers. So remember to buy this book, chaps, from the publisher Wyflings, or you can buy the e-version on Amazon. The Quaker question.
In the comments, Israel is committing a genocide. Israel didn't kill 40,000 of its own civilians, you plonker. I think she's one of your moderators, Ed. So no, this is not the level of your followers.
Paul, I agree.
No, she should. The moderator should ban herself.
No, don't be nasty to Carlotta. She's been here for years.
She's been anti-Semitic for years.
The barmaid at the Jolly Herd. But anyway, there was a study that me and
right-wing mutant.
Let me explain. You asked me a question. In Scandinavian Journal of Psychology, which was withdrawn because the our following in the discussion section of what the peer reviewers told us to do was retrospectively considered offensive by people, even though we were just doing what the peer reviewers told us to do. It's a fascinating case. But anyway, what we showed there is that the correlation, I don't know what the technical word for it is, but the correlation between mental illness and political viewpoint is not curvy linear. It's, I don't know if you can say semi-curvy linear. So basically the left, the more left wing you are, the more the far left are very mentally ill. The conservatives are the ones that are mentally stable. And it's the extreme conservatives that are also mentally ill, but not as mentally ill as the extreme leftists.
So a significant number of people in your comment section are severely mentally ill, but just not quite as much as the severely mentally left-wing spiteful mutant.
Yeah. And that makes sense. In so much as there's now at least three studies I know of that have found that so basically personality disorders, which are normally undergirded by some neuroticism and things like that, narcissism and, well, not always, but in these ones, cluster B ones, narcissism and Machiavellianism, predict being left-wing, and also as does just neuroticism, and the far right is also associated with elements of neuroticism, and particularly with psychopathy. So you like risks, and you're callous, and you like offending people, and things like that, and you're fearless. So you can see how that works. So it's, as I say, not curvy linear, but like a sort of a dipper. You know what I mean? So that would be. And then there was interesting studies on the correlates of anti-Semitism as distinguished from anti-Zionism. And it's a left right thing, isn't it? Anti-Zionism, left wing; anti-Semitism, right wing. And I recall.
I'd push back on the slightly ed. I think it's morphed because the ignorance is shared by the spiteful mutants on the left and the right. So they fail to see, for example, they could detest Israel, but in this particular instance, Israel's needs and America's needs coincide from a foreign policy objective. But their spiteful mutant obsession with Israel means they can't see that.
Possibly, but with reference to the only study I know of where this is broken down, it was being anti-Zionist that was associated with being left-wing and also with narcissism and Machiavellianism, and anti-Semitic in the traditional sense that was associated with being right-wing and also with psychopathy. You're on to something with that point. Basically.
But increasingly, how many of your, spiteful mutant right-wing comment section people actively support the mothers?
It's not good on a live stream to slag off the comments.
Why not? No, they're making anti-Semitic comments, and that they won't answer. That they won't. Where have they ever objected to the 40,000 people being killed in Iran? They'll be silent about that. Doesn't suit their myopic viewpoint.
My issue is that these new anti-Semites are just too stupid for my liking.
I agree, Lipton.
No, they're pathetic. It's like these idiots who get up every day and they talk about the Holocaust being fake, but they have never read a book on the Holocaust. It's really irritating.
But Lipton, we can't insult them too much because it's Ed's business models based on them.
I think so too.
but there's I think there's an element to which if you insult someone perceptively, they quite like it because at least it means they're important to you, and they've got under your skin. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to insult them.
Well, no, I'm from Liverpool. I don't see why ignorant people should just gob off and not be held to account for that. They're provably hypocrites.
You're from Liverpool, and you don't see why ignorant people should be allowed to gob off. How you survived there? When I was trying to ask these people in Liverpool outside Anfield intelligent questions about why is Liverpool like it is? Why is Liverpool considered this happy place? Where they were, it's just the spirit of the place. We're about halfway through. So to those of you new, hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are an online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. We've discussed based science, interesting research, stuff that's happened in the news, and stuff that's suppressed by our woke joke universities. If you are new, would you please subscribe? You subscribe on YouTube and leave a like and all that. Subscribe on Twitter, that's at Jolly Heretic. And could you subscribe on my Substack, that's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most base stuff that I can't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, blogs, films I make, all kinds of malarkey. Remember, if you like what I do, you can support me for the cost of a pint of beer a month. And also remember to buy my brilliant new book, the Quaker question exposing the sect that really rules the world. Next to me, Adam, my other brilliant new book on James Watson. I don't know where I put that. Hang on, I'll do it here. Yes. All planned and professional. My other brilliant new book, Genius Under House Arrest, The Cancellation of James Watson. Okay, now next to me we have... I've told you not to interrupt during this section. And he's been slagging you off and he hates you. Or does he love you? Or is there an interesting border between love and hate, where like borderline personality disorder or something, where it's not quite clear what you are to him or he is to you, or me? And that is a doctor. A chap actually got in touch, a friend of mine who's a lawyer, and he said, "God, Ed, I saw that debate with you and that guy Paul Taylor. God, what ghastly man, what a terrible man. I think you fought your opponent quite well." I said, "Yeah, actually, he's a friend of mine. I'd live stream him once a week." Anyway, sorry, Ed, I didn't mean to overstep the mark. I said, "It's okay, don't worry." Anyway, that is Ayatollah Keir Starmani, also known as Dr. Paul Taylor, and his channel is The Readers of the Lost Art. So go over and subscribe there.
Not all, Ed, can I just point out, not all, but a significant number of the people in the comments section, the channel wouldn't really suit them because it requires an ability to read. I just thought I'd put that out there.
It's very good. And slag me off more, Daddy. Slag me off more. Particularly if they're Generation Z. I was talking to some teachers. I was at Oxford, and they were saying that a lot of these kids, they literally can't read. I mean, they have a pen, an electric pen, which reads the text to them as they move it along the text. That was extraordinary. We are going backwards. I mean, the kids turn up at infant school, and they are not dry. I mean, you should be dry by the time you're three at the latest, I would think. Anyway.
Again, a lot of people in the comments section are incontinent.
Well, yeah, but that's because they're old, elderly and they're friends of yours, Paul. So if you could subscribe, or they're of a certain inclination and they can never trust a fart. Anyway, so if you could subscribe, like Keir Starmer, subscribe over at Paul's channel, which is The Reads the Lost Art, and he has various books on Amazon as well. Good. Then in the bottom corner, we have Dr. Alistair Marshall, who is a researcher in risk management. And what's the name of your Substack, Alistair?
That's a good question. I keep forgetting it. I think it's alistairjmarshall.substack.com.
Okay, so go over and subscribe to alistairjmarshall@substack.com and also buy his book, which I imagine is very expensive, and is called, say it again,
Rereading Pareto and Elite Power and Societal Bipolarization, A Critical Perspective on Metapolitics and Democracy.
Excellent. So go over and purchase that, chaps. And then finally, we have Mr. Lipton Matthews. So please subscribe to his channel, which is just Lipton Matthews. And also, he has various books out that you at the moment, Lipton, on Amazon, I think you do.
Yeah, and one is has been considered by MP Rum, the big one on busting African delusions.
Okay, so I look forward to that. That's taking
big African busts.
Yes, busting African delusions,
deluding African busts. That's aside. So go over and buy that. Okay, chaps. Now we have a question. I forgot. We have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic, Mr. Quinn, and he has sent in the following. Where is it? Here we go. Poem. We look at the unfolding war and wonder just who is it for. Political foxes tick all the right boxes, but can we be sure anymore? Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. Please subscribe to Mr. Quinn's channel, which is called something like Jolly Heretic Poet. And you can buy a book of his Jolly Heretic poetry over on the old Amazon. Okay, we have a very intelligent question from @DeltaRosca125, £2. And he says, do Maltesers taste better out of a box or a bag? I don't think I've eaten any Maltesers since the early 2000s. I don't know. There's probably a box.
They have a black lining to them, and I think it refracts back the Malteseriness of the chocolate.
So it heightens the Malteser sensation. But what if you feel that the Malteser as it is enough, and you don't want it to be super Maltesered?
Well, then you shouldn't be eating them.
Well, no, that doesn't make any sense.
That's like effeminate Malteser consumption. It shouldn't be allowed.
No, so it, you have to really go for it with the Maltese.
Yeah, hardcore Maltese consumption.
Yeah, yeah. And Alistair?
Yeah, I think it's got to be the box, because you've got to think in terms of the whole customer experience. And the plastic just isn't the same.
So that's
plastic to interfere with the sort of the bouquet created by the chocolate and the cardboard together.
I see. That's a very interesting counter argument. And Lipton?
I like Maltesers. They're okay. I don't care about the comparison.
Yeah, but do you think it's better for them to be in a box or a packet?
Maybe the packet.
Why?
I would say the packet because I just like to open it. I don't like the cardboard.
Fair enough. Excellent. Well, thank you just for that question, chaps. And if you have any more intellectual questions, then you can send them in and we will, of course, answer them today. Right. So where was I then? Yes. So moving on. Another thing that's been in the news of late is the promotion by the BBC of an article basically stating that loads and loads of people saying they regret having children. I wonder... And this is in the context in which they're also looking into apparently bringing in a TV tax because not enough people are paying for their TV license. referring to the general theme of today, which is elite theory and so on, I find it incomprehensible, Alistair, what the BBC does. The BBC seems to do everything it can to annoy about sort of 50% of those that. More than that, because it's old people that watch TV, isn't it? I mean, it's basically boomers that watch telly. I don't watch telly. Yeah. Old people watch television, and it seems to be that it does everything it can to annoy old people.
Yeah, exactly.
But putting black people in Victorian dramas as barristers, just ridiculous things. Is there rhyme or reason behind their decision in terms of your theories, or are they just gone mad?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to lock in the license fee so that a reform or restore Britain government doesn't get rid of them altogether. I think they're on the back foot, and they know they're looking at problems over the next 5 or 6 years or so. So that's what that's all about. But I think there should be a campaign for me to be the next director general of the BBC, because I could sort the problems out very, very quickly. I would transform the BBC into a radical digital freedom of speech platform, whereby all of the news programmes would have live comment sections, and people would be able to comment, and there'd be sort of competition. People would be able to sort of rate the commenters. So there'd be super commentators whose views would appear in the live chat as news programs are being broadcast, and that would force the news readers to maintain at least some semblance of political balance. And another thing I would do is I would have a method of distributing funds for program making between, you know, people who bid for it, sort of ordinary members of the public who just create their own YouTube channels. People like Ed, for example, you would be able to bid for money to make programs to appear on the BBC, and people would have a limited, everyone would have a limited number of votes where they could vote for their favorite program makers. So that would increase the funds to their favorite program makers, and that would create a sort of spread of programming which is genuinely in tune with what people want.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult, because a certain kind of psychology, a certain kind of person is going to go into the media, isn't they? Just in the same way that a certain kind of person is going to go into academia, and so it can never be politically unbiased. Because of the bias, the selection, the way in which it works, of the certain kind of person that will go into this.
Ed, I think it's the asymmetry that if you're on the woke end, anything you say will be reinforced, and you're not putting yourself at any risk. If you say anything vaguely conservative, there's likely to be an asymmetrical negative response. So that becomes a self fulfilling, you know, cycle, more and more of the same cult mind. But I've had direct experience of the BBC. It is just like a cult.
Brilliant example, Paul. I don't know why it is refusing to discuss this issue, but now there's a story making the rounds on Twitter and in the Belgian media regarding to Nathan Kafner. So I won't delve into it, but what I will say is that Ibrahim Kendi is an idiot. Ibrahim Kendi has really dumb ideas, and he has never faced consequences for any of them. None. When Ibrahim Kendi was in college, he took that idea seriously about black people being Sun Iceman theory, that crap, and nobody cares.
No, nobody cares, no. Whereas if you say that the whites are the master race, everyone gets really upset.
It's
utterly asymmetrical. Sorry, Paul, what was your experience of the BBC?
Just the cult-like nature. You go into, and then it was interesting. I went down to Broadcasting House a few times, and then because I lived in Manchester, they had on Oxford Road, and then they relocated from Oxford Road to Salford Quays. But the hilarious thing was they redirected to Salford Quays, and loads of the London loveys complained. So Jenny Murray and all the people on Woman's Hour would get the train up, do the programme and get the train down. So none of them actually lived in Salford or anywhere near Manchester. And there was a big hoo-ha, how dare you move up to Salford? And if you think about it, at the time, the vast majority, there's no rugby league south of Birmingham. There's lots of sports that only exist in the north of the UK. Most of the successful football teams at the time are all in the north of the UK. But there was still this, why on earth would we move from London? It's seen as it's a London-centric cult, or it was, and it's probably got worse over time.
Well, it's a British thing. It's a British tradition, and the capital of Britain is London.
But it's not a British... It's so London-centric, though. They don't represent the rest of the country. They never don't even pretend to.
No. And when you become an MP, you effectively have to live in London.
Yeah.
So maybe you've got a constituency in Surrey or maybe a stretch like Winchester, and then you can commute in. But otherwise, you effectively have to live in London. And so then you are drawn into it. You're drawn into the great black pit.
But admittedly, my whole theory breaks down because for years I was saying there should be more regional accents on the BBC. And then Angela Rayner came into politics and I just completely reject all my previous opinions.
Oh, so do I. There's too many. There's like Scottish accents on all the time because it's considered the most beautiful accent or something, isn't there? And it's all the time. I want to hear someone talk like me on the BBC, and you don't. There's not enough people to. I want to go back to like posher than
what?
Me. Like,
you sound like Hugh Edwards.
No, because he sounds Welsh. And now BBC One, it's the Brollies, like that. That's what I want. Now we're down here, and now BBC One, the Brollies. No. I want an authoritative. They brought it back. They took it away for a while. I've noticed in London, they brought it back on some lines of the Underground. Mind the gap. Stand clear of the door. And that is an accent that you don't hear that kind of posh accent. We've dropped an octave. You don't hear that kind of accent anymore. And I believe the guy that says mind the gap has died. But even so, he lives on at least some lines, authoritatively saying mind the gap and stand clear of the doors, please, rather than please mind the gap between the train and the platform edge. Stand clear of the closing doors. Say it.
Yeah, you sound like them, Ed.
You should be a voiceover.
Even Paul at that point couldn't say, I didn't know the people that did the Underground announcements were from Uganda. I did sound like them. It was a correct rendition of what they sound like. And also the worst thing though is if you see something doesn't look right, report it to somebody or other. See it, say it, sort it. If I think it doesn't look right, I won't report it. I won't. I won't, just to spite you, annoying me. You don't get that in Finland. It's a functioning society. You don't get any see it, say it, sorted here. None of that. You just get silence.
Ed, I have a quick point.
Yeah.
I have a quick point. It's about England. England was once known for being polite and having people who were respectful.
Mm.
in the great British Empire. Like, I like the natives in England. I really wish we would go back to England like 1950 or 1940. Native England.
Yes.
That's, you know why I want native England? Because with native England, I could live in London and walk at 12 a.m. I don't want to feel like I'm in Jamaica.
Have you seen the footage of Piccadilly Gardens in Manchester? They show it in the 60s and 70s, and then they show you Crackadilly Gardens today. And Andy Burnham, supposed to be the king of the north, this amazing mayor who can't even have the centre of Manchester inhabitable.
What I don't understand is that they put up signs now. When you get into Heathrow Airport, the first thing you see is a sign saying, "We will not tolerate abusive behaviour towards our staff, and if you do so, you may be prosecuted." Like, what is that saying to foreigners that are coming to England, other than that you are entering basically an unstable, dangerous country?
Exactly.
There shouldn't need to be, and there didn't used to be signs. Either saying don't be abusive or we'll prosecute. That's the really high level one. Or it's basically please be polite. That's the lower level one. But you shouldn't have to tell people to be polite. That's go without saying. And they're in so many. I've seen them in cheap hotels. I've seen them in railway stations. I've seen them on buses.
You spend a lot of time in cheap hotels, Ed.
I do. It saves money. All right, even in not particularly cheap hotels. I mean, it's just everywhere. They shouldn't have
to. You like it cheap, don't you, Ed?
That's what she said. I do. It's admitting defeat, basically, to say that. And they don't bother with it in places like, I don't know, Moldova or Montenegro, where I'm sure people are very impolite. But it's admitting defeat. They shouldn't do that. Alistair, any points, any thoughts on that?
I suppose you can't turn the clock back, as they say, but it's something that I write. One of the points that I make in my book is that we probably need something which I call metapolitical correction. You see, everyone talks about economic correction, but what we really need is metapolitical correction. It's a question of sort of looking for sort of viable models. What's the ideal decade from the 20th century, where you could use that to produce a sustainable balance, you know, a way of life which has got a sustainable balance between elements of liberal individualism and conservative solidarity.
80s.
You know, the problem is the haircuts. I tend to go back a bit before then. There's an argument to be made for the 1950s.
Yes.
It's a fascinating period in culture where how to negotiate your way around the modern world is what cinema was all about. You know, you had sort of John Ford, Frank Capra, etc., making films about what culture should look like, and people at Edward Shills writing about the sacred center of the West and the importance of public service and civic virtue and things.
Yeah, but
like
I think kids being adopted because they're illegitimate is a bit much. That's the 50s. That was going on in the 50s. Indeed, that was going on right up into the 70s, whereas by the 80s, that wasn't happening. That's one of the reasons I wondered about the 80s. No, you're right, Paul. Really? No, good point.
No, you've got the situation where anyone with a double-barreled name came from a posh family. Now it's because they're not quite sure about who the baby father is. It's ridiculous.
There's two kinds of people with double-barreled names these days in a fairly major way. Actually, that used to be the case in Victorian Britain and a bit earlier
it's bad when one half of your surname is your mother guessing.
No, but that's literally what the mothers used to do. If they had a base-born child in the parish records, it would be, let's say the father's name was Benjamin Bridle and the mother's surname was Croft. So she'd call it Benjamin Bridle Croft to make absolutely clear to everybody that this man was the local yeoman, had sex with this shepherdess's daughter.
Alistair, can I ask a quick question while Ed rambles on? Sorry, Ed. Lipton and I have been going on about consequences all the time. So what you were saying about this reset, it strikes me that on the one hand, there are all these institutions that have drifted so far and become, you know, basically autonomous and they're uncontrollable. Yeah. But on the other hand, if a government came in and basically said, if you're a police commissioner or a chief inspector who screws up, you're sacked with no pension. Overnight, that would introduce consequences that would solve a lot of our policing problems. If the College of Policing was just banned or, you know, taken away straight away, there are certain key things that would have a disproportionate effect. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But it's, I mean, so we're So your point is that we're in an institute. There's an institutional environment now where there are no consequences, where people can simply do what they want without. I mean, that's certainly true of universities, to a large extent. So the question is, what do you do about that? So your solution to this would be punitiveness.
Yeah, and in the case of universities, you know, we could throw around numbers, but it's, you know, a large percentage of university finances now and staff are in non-productive roles, meaning they don't teach, they don't research, they just do endless admin. Well, if there's a VC who has a certain percentage of staff who are only doing admin, they could have their pay reduced. There could be, there's various methods of introducing consequences into institutions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just not followed at the moment.
Yeah. And of course, introducing private sector performance measurements and management techniques into the education system, that's been tried. That's arguably created a lot of bureaucracy. A big part of the problem is bureaucracy itself.
But if you said 20% of your simple target, so it's like reverse Stalinism, only 20% of your university can be devoted to admin, sorted out. That would be a 20% improvement on the current situation, roughly.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, universities are obviously undergoing big challenges at the moment, which I think are being under-recognized. It's a fascinating thing. The effect that, I mean, AI has had this incredible effect, whereby I've noticed over the past couple of years that a large number of students are just using AI to write their essays, and they're doing very well. It used to be the case a few years ago that, well, I've got lots of international students who I teach. They used to write in poor English. Now they're writing in brilliant English. Something. So this is a huge change over the past couple of years. So it has seriously compromised the teaching and learning model, and also the assessment model. And so the response to this has been either more bureaucracy, more support, more guidance and support on how to integrate AI into teaching and learning and assessment, and so rather than simplifying things, you'd expect. I mean, there's a potential for radical simplification with the growing use of AI, but rather than that, it's the opposite. It's resulted in more bureaucracy. And of course, when you look at students ending up with lifetime debts of £100,000. And on top of that, you've got the opportunity cost of not being able to save. So that's effectively doubling the problem over the course of a student's lifetime. It's horrible to consider the amount of money that they're shoveling into.
There was some interesting research that was published today. The essay was called Baby Bust by some think tank or other. So the result of all this, this debt is one of the reasons why young men are delaying having children, and young men in Generation Z and whatever, and they're delaying having children. Of course, when they do have children, they'll have them with younger women. So the result of that will be a kind of a new spinster crisis of the kind we had 100 years ago or so, where Generation Z women will be supplanted by whatever the new one's called, Generation Alpha, and won't be able to have babies, at least won't be able to with men they find attractive that are reasonably middle class and reasonably high status. It's going to cause that. And then that could be interesting, because then what happened last time this occurred, where there was an excess of women, the Victorian spinster crisis, was women became super purity signalling in order to bag the right men. So it would actually make them more right wing. So that's quite interesting.
Baby Bust, the Center for Social Justice. I know that research group.
Yeah, so it's doing, the consequences of this are absolutely terrible. And if they just followed the Marquess of Salisbury's basic idea, which is that all change is bad and our policy should be there's as little of it as possible, then
I want to speak to Alice there. I have a question. When teachers complain that students are using AI to write essays, yeah, what do they mean? Hold on for a second. I think somebody wants me to open the door.
Of course they do.
I'll answer slowly in the hope that Lipton gets back soon.
Well, they could do, because when I was in the first year of, as I was a postgrad, my university said you've got to type your essays. So they used to say you could hand write them, and then it would be that you type them. So I think one way we can deal with this AI nonsense is to say that essays must be handwritten.
Well, Ed, no, because the AI could just print off AI and then handwrite it. The only way, but it's incredibly simple, go back to the old system of exams.
Yeah, yes. But that can't work either now, because...
It can't work, so the students can't deal with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's the mental health crisis.
When I was at university, not with all of my tutors, but with some of them, you know what you had to do? You'd have, let's say, four people in a tutor group, and you had to read the tutor and then these one, two, three other people. You had to read your essay to them, and then they would intervene and say, have you thought of this or whatever like that, and then at the end of your reading it, you'd get a mark.
Okay.
They had one on two tutorials. Mine was one on four, I guess.
I am back. Yeah, so what do these teachers mean when they say that students are using AI to write essays? I would love to know.
Yeah, well, the guidance for students now is to use AI, because there's no point stopping them, because they're going to do it anyway. So the guidance says use AI, but always remember to preserve your author's voice. So that the work... Exactly. So that the work can be considered
go through the essay and intersperse it with the word like.
Exactly. And so the crazy thing is that it's not actually acknowledged as the apocalypse for the educational model that it should be recognized as. And if you think about why that is. And you think about what universities are doing. They're making money by getting bums on seats, especially for international students. And if these international students don't do well, then their retention rates are going to fall. And if their retention rates fall, then they get into trouble with UKVI. So the fact that international students are actually using AI en masse is, you know, paradoxically, it's helping the system to keep running.
Ed, what percentage of your Quaker book was written by AI?
None.
No, but I have another point, Alice, dear, because I have used most of the important large language models, and I find that they struggle to do basic calculations. They're not good at research. So if you say to AI, any of these AI models, give me a study on the economy of India in 1992, they will give you a study that was published in 2025 or 2022, and that's okay, that's a relevant study, but they cannot retrieve a study that was published in 1897. They cannot show you a study that was published in 1950. they can't even show you a study that was published in 2010 that didn't get 200 citations.
Yeah.
Well, they shouldn't be. So it completely undermines the university system. Everyone's going to get firsts. It's insane. It's absolutely. If they're using AI, there's no. How can you distinguish between quality if everyone's using AI?
AI cannot think like a person. An AI written essay, if you say to AI, write an essay, AI will give you an essay that's quite generic, and then there's the hallucination problem. For AI to write an appropriate essay, you'd have to give it a prompt. Let's say a prompt that's a real essay, like tell it exactly what you want it to say. Like you'd have to say, AI, write an essay saying that in 1950, Nigeria had 10 people, two of them went to UK, John Brown's mother was fat because she had diabetes. You have to be specific. You cannot just say to AI, write an essay about Nigeria and get a proper essay.
I use it to find academic research. So I'll say, is there any research on this specific relationship between this and this? And often it gets it right. But I found, particularly in the ancient civilizations book that I was writing, or I've been writing, it would just make stuff up. It would just make stuff up. And
that's when you really started using it.
Now, let me tell you what AI did to me once. I wrote a piece once and edited the piece. And I said, okay, AI, it was ChatGPT. I plugged the piece into ChatGPT and I said, I want this to be edited. This is what you should do. And AI basically removed the information. It didn't compose what I wanted to compose it. It took out entire sections. I said, edited, not change the style. And just made up stuff and
Alistair, can I back up, you know, the point you made? I remember being an external examiner at a university whose name I won't mention, and it was for a master's course that had a disproportionate number of people from a particular country. And I pointed out that at master's level, the essay they had to do said on the instructions, you should spend 150 words doing your introduction, 250 words, and so on. And I said, for a university of decent standing, that was demeaning to the students. And this was at an examiner's meeting, and the response was, but if we don't do that, they won't be able to do their essays, as if I was the problem. And I said, don't you see why that might be a problem of standards? Yeah. And they said, no, because as you've pointed out, the whole point is to earn the money, the foreign currency of foreign students.
It's corrupt. The guidance is incredible. You reach a point where it's not a good idea to provide any more guidance, because it just starts to confuse them. Because you start to trip over yourself by sort of duplicating what you say by saying the same things in slightly different ways. And so there's a lot more scope for misinterpretation of what they're supposed to do. So there's always an optimal amount of guidance, but the hunger for guidance is much greater. I'd say that the problem is actually far greater with UK students. And again, it goes back to the mental health crisis and the need for validation. In exams, they really don't like exams because that would put them in the hot seat. That means they're being tested in real time, and they can't handle that. So that's a very real issue. But I saw this something happened. Something happened, and it was around 2015, 2016. A lot more students started putting in appeals for special considerations. And it's all sorts of vague neuroses. So, you know, oh, I can't quite handle this deadline, and I'm okay, and I haven't seen a doctor, and it's just, you know, I just like another couple of weeks, and everything will be okay. It's stuff like that started to become a lot more common, and of course, the appeals procedure starts to get clogged up. You know, the bureaucracy quickly starts to get clogged up to the point where it can't cope. So all of that happened maybe about 8, 9, 10 years ago. it really started to change things.
I'd slightly disagree, Alistair, to the extent that if you got rid of it, it's not that the bureaucracy couldn't handle it, it's the bureaucracy became self-generating in order to handle it.
Yeah,
if this goes back to my point, if you said only 20% of your staff can do admin, they wouldn't have all these endless appeals.
That's true. And I mean, there's a solution, which is you can have a system where the students self-certify, so they can give themselves an extra week, which of course undermines the whole point of having a level playing field.
Or doctor. It was starting when it's very terrible. I know, and if this guy's watching, it's not your fault. I'm not going to go at you, but I did think it was a bit much. This poor chap, in his first year, his mother died. Right, not good, not nice, understandable, awful. Now, what I'm thinking is the right thing to do. Maybe he could take a year out. I don't know what to suggest, but what they basically did was they said, "Well, you know, we'll just give you a 2-1," and that's what happened. So he was basically told, "Well, you know, try in the exams, but because your mother's died, you'll get a 2-1."
He didn't and kill her.
And I don't believe so. I assume he was telling me the truth, but then I know another chap whose mother died in his first year. And I don't think he took advantage of any of this stuff. And he a very clever guy, but obviously it was a terrible thing. And it was a pressure on him because his dad was dead as well. So he was 19 and an orphan, really, if that's possible. I know he got a 2-2. So there must have been some mechanism that the other chap bothered to find out about and then took advantage of. And I thought that was rather unfair. You know, if you go into a lot of people experience the death of a grandparent when they were at university, of course. It's difficult. You know, I don't think it's fair though to just give a person a high degree. Well, what's the average these days, isn't it? Average degree grade, just because the parent dies. But that's the kind of thing that went on even in the early 2000s.
Well, I originally it was not a big deal, but in retrospect, it has become a big deal. So I like to get A's, and I've said this story before, but Alistair didn't hear it. So I went to university in the UK, right? And I had a thesis to write. I wrote it in 2 weeks. I did not use AI. And then the external marker gave me an A, and the internal marker, the person who was supervising the exam, who was supervising the thesis, she was always marking my in-class exams. I got a B from her. And they settled. She's a black woman, but apparently, I should have known better. Let me tell you what I did. When I was writing the thesis, I quoted this Dutch academic. He's controversial, but he wasn't the problem. I basically said, look, Indian indentureship wasn't that bad. I should have known better, and I can't get over it. I should have gotten a distinction.
Yeah, well, you'd have got a distinction if you just said racism is bad.
Yeah, no, seriously, I should have gotten a distinction. I didn't use AI, and like, they want black students to get a first and whatever, and I'm black, so why didn't they give me the first?
Did you get 2-1, Lipton?
It was for the MSc.
Right.
He got a merit, I think he's saying, he got a merit.
Yes, and I missed it by what? By, let's say, about 2 points, something like that.
Well, well done. But yeah, that's probably because you had a biased lecturer. So that was just, it's ridiculous. You know, she didn't understand.
Lipton, you're black and you're racist.
No, she's really left. She was a bit. She's left. She was saying that indentureship was like slavery. That's what the argument
she
and whatever.
Slavery was bad, and you were saying no, it was good, and it was just
I was basically amazing. Saying, look, like the smart Brahmins, they did well in Trinidad, and like people can get over indentureship. It's not all that bad, and whatever.
Yeah, that's the case. So, but so the university is falling. But you know, when I was doing this, I was this thing at Oxford University a few weeks ago. They've effectively got rid of the college system. I didn't know this. So the college system was that you surely, was that you could live in college for all 3 years of your degree. You were doing your degree at Pembroke College, Oxford. You live in Pembroke College, Oxford. That was always the case. And now, to make money, you're guaranteed to live in college in your first year, but not in your second year at all. And in your third year, there's some kind of room ballot. And even when I was at Durham, you were guaranteed, you had to live out in your second year, but you were guaranteed to live in your first year and your third year. And now the only people that are guaranteed to live in are first years and PhD students. And so they've ended the college system in Oxford. It's over. It's appalling. I can't believe that's happened. And now they live in these areas of Oxford where the rape gangs were from and whatever, these kinds of areas just outside the city. It's terrible. So even Oxford, and I assume Cambridge as well, is gone. It's over. And it's all to do with money. And then you see the amount of Chinese students there is amazing. It's amazing. It's just... Yeah.
Well, not just Oxford. Have you seen the first front row of Anfield when there's a match on?
I imagine they're all posh.
No, all Chinese.
Oh my God.
Seriously, the first row, when the cameras, you know, show someone taking a throw in, all around the ground, the first row are Chinese people.
Why would they want to go and see a Liverpool football match?
Well, at the moment, yeah, that's true.
Or no, but if they're not from there. I mean,
because it's global football. Alistair wouldn't understand because Scottish football's never really reached beyond its own borders. But the Premier League is an international commodity.
That's appalling. I mean, if you're going to have a goalkeeper like Jim Leighton for your national team and he's going to let goals in through his legs.
He actually had bandy legs, didn't he?
I don't know, but I know in the 1990 World Cup, which they qualified.
Yeah, if you go back and look at the footage, he had legs like he'd been riding a horse non-stop for 5 years, which isn't good if you're a goalkeeper because his legs were ball-shaped. Right. The ball went through.
And he was the best goalkeeper Scotland could provide. That's the thing. That's the thing. He had bandy legs that made he let goals in through his legs. And he
couldn't catch anything.
And he was the best goalie Scotland could provide. So it tells you something, and the best footballer apart from a goalie was Mo Johnson. Is that his name? Mo Johnson. I don't know.
Archie Gemmell was good, wasn't he, Alistair?
Yeah.
I'm going back a long way here. And there was Pat Bonner. He was the goalkeeper for Celtic.
Yeah.
I think he was Irish.
He was Irish.
I think he played for Northern Ireland. And we're going off topic a bit here, but that's what the show's about. Scottish footballers.
No. Well, he ruined Alan Hansen's one of the best defenders the world's ever seen, and when he played for Scotland, he was rubbish.
No, they're not good at football. They're better at they're not good at sport.
they're better at
haggis.
Yeah, but to be fair to the Scots, it's difficult to perform at a high level athletically when you've got rickets and you've been brought up on iron brew.
Yeah, in Brew. Yes, that is true. It's not. They're not. They're good at curling. There you go. The Scots. It's the kind of their sport, and they invented it. But they are good at curling. They're good at curling. I'll give that to the Scots. Right. Well, cheers, everybody. I'm sure we can agree that has been fascinating. So remember to subscribe to Alistair Marshall's Substack. And to buy his book, just put Alistair Marshall into Amazon because it's a really complicated title that we're never going to remember. I'd like to thank Alistair for coming on. And see you all next week. Yes, I will be here next week. So we will see you all next week. And tally-ho, chaps. And have a good week and all that. And let's hope World War III doesn't completely break out by next Monday. And we will see you all soon. And goodbye.